So today is the final day of our seminar, of all the seminars, unfortunately. But I just wanted to begin with a little bit of one actual realization that from yesterday's session that Shachinandan Maharaj said after the class. And that was after doing the whole exercise, he was saying he realized just how well you need to know your text in order to do it properly. That all the verses, all the ins and outs of the literature must be known to the person trying to do it. We only were trying to come up with one viable scheme in each situation, right, for each book. But imagine if you had to defend your scheme from several other schemes that other people had come up with, because we weren't dealing with so much with alternate schemes that might object to yours. That was not there. So if you had to do that, then you would have to know basically not just the verses you know and can use to create a particular scheme, but everything else in the book that you can account for that in case it's necessary, right? So it becomes a much more difficult task. And based on that, we can just imagine Jiva Goswami, when he did it for the 18,000 verses of Srimad Bhagavatam, just how deeply he must have known the text. Just from this and from all of the sandarbhas in which he's selecting verses and stories from all over the Srimad Bhagavatam, from places that we wouldn't normally think of selecting verses from. But he's doing it, and it shows very well that how in-depth and what a deep knowledge he has of Srimad Bhagavatam. So it just gives us a little bit of appreciation for the task that Jiva Goswami accomplished, just how formidable it was.
But did he have to defend his selection against other?
I'm not actually sure whether within his lifetime he had any. There's no stories of him being confronted by others.
Or like what about people prior to Jiva Goswami who did the same thing?
Again, on the Srimad Bhagavatam, I don't think there was anything done. But the thing is, when you're doing something like this, then you do it with the idea that someone will come and refute it, because this is the usual standard. I mean, this is how it works. So you have to do it in such a way that you're already planning. You're pre-thinking. You're thinking ahead as to what the other person's objections might be, right? To deal with it beforehand. Just like, for example, we talked about the opening verse and the concluding verse. They both have to match. Well, there's this debate that arises that what if for some reason or other they don't match, like they're just completely different. No verse near the beginning is matching and no verse near the end. You know, then what do you do? And which is superior, which has greater weight, which is stronger, the opening verse or the concluding? The Shankaracharya says that the opening verse is more important. It sets out the main ideas, the points. This is because he needs this to be true, because in the Vedanta Sutra, the first sutra suits his philosophy very well, but the last one does not. And so the two actually don't match very well. And so he needs to consider the first one stronger, otherwise he's in big trouble. Madhvacharya, as can be expected, as he does on almost everything, he goes completely 180 degrees opposite to Shankara and says, no, it's the conclusion that's strongest. It's almost by default that anything Shankara will say, Madhvacharya will try to prove the opposite, because he hates the Mayavadis like anything. So he says, no, the Upasanghara, the final, is the most powerful. So the first, there's one author in the Shankara Sampradaya who wrote a book called Upakrama Parakrama, the victory of the opening statement, the power, the greatness of the opening statement. A follower of the Madhvacharya camp, in response to that, wrote Upasanghara Vijaya, the victory of the concluding statement. After that, I don't remember the name, someone else came back and wrote a refutation of that work to show again that the opening statement is the strongest. So in this way, things go back and forth. And there's many examples of Vedantic issues, very, very sort of, you could say, theoretical, uninteresting, you know, minute issues, being debated back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. Over generations. There's one particular Sri Vaishnav professor in South India who's recently written a rebuttal to work that was written 200 years ago, which was in itself a refutation of something written a few hundred years before that, and like that, it goes back all the way through the parampara, you know, so back and forth.
Then in the opening lecture you mentioned that nobody refuted so far Jiva Goswami's Satsangadas. It kind of alarmed me in the sense that you may not refute it because it's irrefutable, but there is another much more plausible reason, is that you just don't care and nobody cares. So this kind of gave me a little, I don't know, what is the real reason why nobody even tried to refute it?
Yeah.
Because nobody cared about it? Or?
Like I said at the beginning, nothing gets past Bhaktivedanta. I thought of the same thing when I was doing my work, and I was thinking, well, because this argument comes up actually in one of the other, there's one study done on the Tattva Sandarbha. This point is made, you know, and devotees make this point. But then I was thinking, well, that could be a result of simply it's not important, you know. Like if you ignore something, it's the worst form of criticism because you don't even take it seriously. That's possible. That could be the case. Because the Sandarbhas haven't had much time, historically speaking. They're only 500 years old. And Sanskrit debate has pretty much died off 200 years ago. 200 years, I'd say. You know, after Baladev Vibhushana, then the colonialists came to India, and it pretty much, the tradition of Sanskrit debate went down. So it had very little time, maybe 200-300 years. I think the best way to find out would be if we now popularize the Sandarbhas, right, and use their arguments and see if we get any comebacks from that. I think that would be a good test. Otherwise, historically, I don't know which is the proper cause of it, whether it's simply people ignoring or inability to refute. But in any case, and no one has come back with anything, so we can still test that out today, I think.
Are you getting any arguments?
Well, my thing hasn't been published yet, so we'll see. But again, that debate that tradition of debate has pretty much died out, unfortunately, in India. It still happens in a few scholarly circles, you know, but the great tradition where, you know, whole sort of villages would come to listen to two masters fight for 3 days on end, that sort of stuff is pretty much gone now. Okay, so anyway, that was about yesterday. Now, today is the final day, and I want to get to Vedanta today, since that was in the title of the seminar series.
And so it's more important about karma.
what did you get out of the series? Well, upasanghara is more important than upakrama. The concluding statement, I'll remember that for my future. No, we'll try to do something with Vedanta today. But since this is the last day, therefore if you have any questions any way through, please feel free to ask them, because you won't get another opportunity in the future. Is this board okay here, or should I move it up here? Vedanta. Now, to start this, let me go back to Bhaktivedanta Maharaj's question about 3 days ago that I've been promising to answer. And the question was, if I remember correctly, why is it that if Jiva Goswami wanted to make a philosophical treatise, a statement to the rest of the world, to all the different philosophical schools, presenting our philosophy in a way they could appreciate, which is what he's trying to do in the Sandarbhas, right? Then why doesn't he do it through the medium of a Vedanta Sutra commentary? Why doesn't he write a commentary on Vedanta Sutra like everyone else does? Was that the question? Because, you see, Vedanta, for thousands of years, in any school of Indian philosophy, theistic philosophy based on the Vedas, if someone wants to make a point, if they want to present their philosophy, then the standard way of doing it is writing a commentary on Vedanta Sutra. This is how a school becomes, a sampradaya becomes accepted as a sampradaya in its own standing. This became an issue actually for our own tradition in the 18th century with Baladeva Vidyabhushana, and people challenged our sampradaya, saying, "You're not an authorized sampradaya, you have no commentary on the Vedanta Sutta." So he then wrote one. But why is it that Jiva Goswami himself did not write a commentary? This is a very interesting and very crucial question to understand what is going on in the Sandarbhas, why Jiva Goswami is doing what he's doing. Now, let me start in the answer, let me start with a little more of a general reason and then a more specific reason. Generally speaking, in our tradition, we have a little bit of antipathy, a little bit of dislike, distaste for the pursuit of knowledge, cultivation of jnana. Because in our fundamental definition of bhakti, right, we have jnana karma jnana vitam, that pure devotional service is uncovered, unobscured by jnana or by karma, by the cultivation of knowledge. And jnana is seen as something that can create a hardening of the heart, which makes it very difficult for the bhakti to enter, for the heart to be soft so bhakti can enter. It leads to the growth of pride and the growth of speculation. The mind goes in all different directions. And it's very difficult. My Guru Maharaj says, eating the bananas of the mind. This is not very healthy for spiritual life. It's what philosophers do. But our tradition is distinct from that. We're not philosophers, we're devotees. So there's this general distaste, dislike for knowledge, for just the pure cultivation of knowledge in our tradition. And this is not something unique to our tradition. In fact, in the 16th century, when Gaudiya Vaishnavism was rising, there were many other bhakti movements as well, which had similar feelings towards knowledge. Most of the great bhakti poets, like Surdas and others, they sing about, you know, how useless knowledge is. You know, what's the point of cultivating knowledge? And you know, I'm not interested in all of that. I'm simply interested in worshipping the son of Nanda Maharaj. And he, you know, the famous verse, he who whom all the Vedas are praising, and great philosophers and scholars are trying to figure out with their intelligence, and he whom is being, you know, the Upanishads are trying to grasp with their knowledge, that supreme Brahman is playing as a little child in the courtyard of Nanda Maharaj. So as for me, I prefer to worship Maharaj Nanda, in whose courtyard that supreme Brahman is having a good time. So this is our general approach, and this is the approach of other schools at that time, also other sampradayas at that time. Yet we also know from the Chaitanya Charitamrita that some element of knowledge is necessary. Knowledge can be helpful as a foundation for the cultivation of bhakti. Just like in the story of Prakashananda Saraswati and Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya that we told on the first day, it's very clear there that some pursuit or conveyance of jnana, of this philosophy, was necessary in order to break down the misconceptions that these philosophers had and sort of open up their heart enough so that bhakti could enter. In the end, the result was the same. Lord Chaitanya gave them Krishna prema like he gave everyone else. Some people he gave just by embracing, others he had to debate for a week. The result was the same. But the thing was, sometimes the methods used were different. Different methods were necessary. So Jiva Goswami says in his commentary on this verse, Anya Abhilashita Shunyam Jnana Karma Dinaditam, in the definition of bhakti, he says, although knowledge is not a component of bhakti, it's not necessary for bhakti, but sometimes it can be useful in order to prepare the ground for bhakti, sort of as a sort of forerunner of bhakti. The verse says, "Jnana karma jnanavidam." It's uncovered by knowledge and karma, right? But you can think of it, it's uncovered, but that doesn't mean they cannot sit underneath as a basis. Okay, so this is exactly the question. This is precisely the point, because what is meant by knowledge? this is basically the crucial question. You see, earlier sampradayas, such as, just to draw a contrast, such as Ramanuja and Madhvacharya, their approach with jnana is very different. They define bhakti as a specific form of jnana. So Madhvacharya says it's a type of jnana, it's a type of knowledge, bhakti. And Ramanujacharya says that it's these things, terms are synonymous. Knowledge in its purest form is bhakti. Bhakti includes knowledge. So he's treating them quite synonymously. Vedana, upasana, worship, and jnana, knowledge is the same thing. We, on the other hand, come out with the term and we say, no, it's rejected and it cannot be impeding upon the process of bhakti. Now, the question is, what kind of knowledge are we talking about? Some of the sampradayas that were contemporary with Gaudiya Vaishnavism, such as, for example, the Hit Harivamsa sampradaya, which still exists in Vrindavan, they come from Hit Harivamsa was their leader, Radha Vallabhi. Right? They have the Radha Vallabha temple in Vrindavan. They were very strong about this, and they included in knowledge any sort of intellectual endeavor. So the study of Shastra, even to the point of study of Srimad Bhagavatam, they can say, we do not need this stuff. All they depend on is the songs of Hita Harivamsa. This is all they accept. And they say that when we start using books, one word for book in Sanskrit is called grantha. Do you know what grantha means?
Knot.
Binding, right? The sort of the historical reason for this is because manuscripts that they used had a little blank spot in the middle always, and you punched a hole through that and you tied it. It was binding basically, a knot. So grantha means a book, which means a knot, literally. So they say that if you go to a grantha, if you use a grantha book, this creates a knot in the heart, which cannot be pierced. The only thing you need is to enjoy the sweetness of Krishna Leela. And this can be done through the sound vibration from the songs of a pure devotee, namely Hitta Harivamsa. So service to devotees and listening to the songs, this is their method. And they reject everything else. Now, thankfully, Chaitanya Vaishnavism does not go so far. We say, no, knowledge, the type of knowledge we reject is knowledge for the sake of knowledge, which usually ends up meaning impersonal knowledge, the type of knowledge that you find the Mayavadis cultivating. Knowledge that is true, it's real, it's about our personal identity, who we are, but is disconnected from Krishna. This is that verse we were quoting earlier, Achyuta Bhava Varjita, without the emotion of devotion to Krishna, just knowledge for its own sake. So this is rejected.
So what is the symptom that you study our scriptures for the sake of knowledge, that you do it for the sake of bhakti?
The basic thing that you find from the Chaitanya Charitamrita, from all our literatures, is that the cultivation of knowledge is acceptable and authorized when it very clearly is intended to lead to the goal of prema, of love for Krishna. So let me give you one example from Chaitanya Charitamrita. In Jagannath Puri, when Lord Chaitanya was living there in his the last part of his life, then Swarup Damodar was his secretary, right? And many people would come, and they would Chaitanya Mahaprabhu would like to hear Krishna Katha. He would listen to poems about Krishna, songs about Krishna, readings from Srimad Bhagavatam, like that. But anything that came to Lord Chaitanya was first screened by Swarup Damodar, right? He would have to look at it first, make sure it was okay. So one day this poet came who had written a play about Lord Jagannath and about Lord Chaitanya, both of them, and wanted to recite his poetry to Lord Chaitanya. The Swarup Damodar said, no, I'm not interested. He didn't even listen to me. He said, flat out, no. But he was very determined, and he recited to the other devotees, and the devotees were very impressed and said, wow, this is really good, this is nice. And he sort of created a whole sort of atmosphere, you know, and everyone is supporting him, and they all came to Swarup Dhamma and said, why don't you just give it a try, listen to it once, it's not that bad, we've listened to it, please, he's eager like that. So Swarup Dhamma was not interested, but they pushed him and they pushed him and they pushed him. He said, finally, okay, so give me something. So he recited the first verse of his composition, and the poor guy did not get beyond even the first verse before Swarup Dhamma came down so heavily upon him. And basically his mistake was that in that verse, in an attempt to be poetical, to have a nice allegory, he was comparing Jagannath to the body and Lord Chaitanya to the soul. And Lord Chaitanya is the soul of the body called Jagannath. By his presence here in Jagannath Puri, he's giving life to Lord Jagannath. We can see Lord Jagannath moving. So whatever his intentions were, I don't know. But in an effort to be poetical, he gave a serious siddhantic error, which is basically, you know, impersonalism. Like there's a difference between the body and soul of Krishna. So Swarup Dhamma pointed this out, became very heavy with him. And in these verses he says, what right do you think you have? What pride do you have to think that you can write anything about the Lord and his activities without being properly trained in kavya, in Sanskrit poetry, in vyakarana, in grammar, in alankara, ornamentation, in all the shastras and all the scriptures, in all these different fields of learning, without being properly trained in these, what right do you think you have to actually to compose verses like that? He said, you're completely foolish and you're completely arrogant. The man, needless to say, was completely devastated, and broke down. But the good quality he had was that instead of becoming angry and leaving, he accepted it, and he sort of fell down in a sorry state, begged forgiveness, and Swarup Dhamma then softened a little bit, and he said, it's okay, you did this out of ignorance. He said, but if you want to be a real scholar, then go study Srimad Bhagavatam with a devotee, with a Vaishnava, and that knowledge, through that knowledge, he can reveal the true meanings of the Shastras to you, and your heart will become softened and ready to glorify the Lord. So this is a clear instance how he was insisting that he gained all this knowledge about, you know, different areas of learning inside because of the type of service he wanted to do. But the point was, it has to be directed towards the goal of actually developing love for Krishna and serving the Vaishnavas, not with a view of displaying your scholarly abilities. So that's the key. In all the stories you see, when that direction, that motivation is clear, then it's acceptable.
But there was another one in Chaitanya Charitamrita who was well trained, and he was also Balabha Bhakt.
Right.
So he had those qualifications, but still.
The goal wasn't clear. You see, the motivation wasn't clear. His motivation there was, I can present a better commentary than Srila Swami. I can present a better commentary than my predecessor, Acharyas. So the motivation was incorrect. You see, ultimately, in all these things, it boils down to motivation. This is what we said the first day of the class also. Right? There's no knowledge without motivation. If the motivation is incorrect, then jnana will lead to fall down. But if it's correct, then it can be utilized properly. So this was basically...
I'm just thinking, wonder what these other schools would think of that purport in the first canto where Prabhupada says things like chemistry and psychology, etc., when used in the service of the Lord if actually trying to.
This comes exactly to the next point I'm making, which ties into the Srimad Bhagavatam. And that's... this is the point. Jiva Goswami, he was facing this challenge, right? He had this challenge before him. On the one hand, he had this antipathy, this dislike of knowledge, of jnana, right? Which was sort of prevalent in the whole tradition and everything. On the other hand, he wanted to bring the tradition into the Vedantic arena so Lord Chaitanya's philosophy can be established in a very solid way. So how do you engage in Vedanta? How do you engage in the pursuit of knowledge? And at the same time, stay faithful to this idea that knowledge for its own sake is no good. We want bhakti. This is what we're interested in. You notice practically all the other Goswamis were writing stories about Krishna, about his leelas, plays, things like much more tasteful things, much more rasika things. So how does Jiva Goswami accomplish this? And the basic answer is through the Srimad Bhagavatam. the Bhagavatam provides a wonderful bridge between knowledge and devotion. It welds together bhakti and jnana. It intertwines devotional emotions with philosophical pursuit. The Bhagavatam, because of its nature, it's such a deep philosophical work. You read these prayers, right? Prayers of the personified Vedas to Krishna, for example. There's so many commentaries written on that with such intense philosophical material going back and forth. Including the Goswamis, they write very heavy commentaries also because they're very rich with a theoretical philosophical argument. But at the same time, like we spoke about yesterday, the whole point of it, that everything's directed to Krishna, the repetition, right? Every word in every sentence, the Bhagavatam is simply glorifying Bhagavan over and over again. This is the uniqueness of the Bhagavatam. Nothing is disconnected from Krishna. So it provides the perfect bridge. Basically, anything you can do through Srimad Bhagavatam, any philosophy you can present on the basis of Srimad Bhagavatam, will be acceptable to any of the devotees, any of the members of the Sampradaya. Because the Bhagavatam is Nigamakalpataro Galitam Thalam Shukamukhad Amritatrava Sangyutam Pivata Bhagavatam Rasamalayam. It's the very container of rasa. So if you can show, you can do all the philosophy you want, as long as you're using the container of rasa, then everything is rasa. The whole Bhagavatam is just a fruit of rasa, this fruit full of juice. I mean, it's a fruit that Srila Swami says has no seed and no skin. It's just a fruit that's completely composed of juice. If you can imagine what that kind of fruit would be. There's no section of the Bhagavatam, you know, unlike a regular fruit that you need to peel off and throw away. This is sort of extra stuff. The whole Srimad Bhagavatam, top to bottom, is just juice. It's nectar. So the Bhagavatam creates this wonderful bridge. And therefore, when Jiva Goswami sets out to do his Vedanta, he does it on the basis of Srimad Bhagavatam. This is further helped by the fact that we regard the Srimad Bhagavatam to be the best commentary on the Vedanta Sutra. It was written by Srila Vyasadeva himself. And therefore, he explains it better than any other human commentary can. So it all works very well. Jiva Goswami decides, I'll take the Srimad Bhagavatam, I'll do my Vedanta based on the Srimad Bhagavatam. The Srimad Bhagavatam is the commentary of Vedanta Sutra, therefore we don't need a separate one, but I will bring that out through the Sandarbhas. I'll bring out how Srimad Bhagavatam comments on Vedanta Sutra. And in this way, the devotees are very happy because they're learning more about Srimad Bhagavatam, and the outsiders are happy because they understand the tradition treats the Bhagavatam in this way, and here's a real commentary, although it's not directly on the Vedanta Sutra, it's dealing with the same issues through the Srimad Bhagavatam. So Jiva Goswami was able to strike a very nice balance. This was his genius, that he could accomplish both tasks at once. He could stay faithful to our tradition, and at the same time, he could satisfy those outside the tradition. Not a very easy task to accomplish.
I asked a similar question the first day, I believe. But again, my question is that our Gaudiya Vaishnava claim of Bhagavatam as the commentary, authentic commentary, or probably the best commentary or true commentary of Vedanta Sutra, to what degree that claim is accepted? Because I know one argument saying that, well, usually one writes, let's say, Vyasadeva wrote Vedanta Sutra, but usually somebody else, the people comes later, make comment on
it. Not necessarily, there are so many. Sadhanga Swami wrote his own commentaries on behalf of Vedanta. So many.
Jiva Goswami, the first thing he does is he defends this idea that the Bhagavatam is a natural commentary. And he quotes especially from the Garuda Puran, which says, Arthoyam Dhamma Sutranam, that it's talking about Srimad Bhagavatam and saying this scripture, it's describing all the different Puranas. Many Puranas have this, they have a description of the other Puranas in them. So when it comes to describing Srimad Bhagavatam, then it says, Arthoyam Brahma Sutranam, this Purana is the meaning of the Brahma Sutras of the Vedanta Sutra. And then he's also making that argument simply by showing that the meanings are present. That in itself is evidence. Right? What he does is he takes the first verse of Srimad Bhagavatam, Janmadhyasayatonvayat, and he takes the first five sutras of the Vedanta Sutra and he correlates the two. He says, look at the meanings of the first five sutras. They are present, each one of them, in the first verse of Srimad Bhagavatam. Okay, so he's drawing this correlation. In that way, he's very clearly supporting that claim. Actually, just as a side note, this verse from the Garuda Puran, that the Bhagavatam is the meaning of the Vedanta Sutra, this has been used by, you know, our acharyas quite often to substantiate our claim. But in the about 100-150 years ago, in the Hindu Renaissance, when this new Vedanta came up, Ram Mohan Roy, one famous individual in Bengal, around the time of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he criticized Chaitanya Vaishnavism and said that these people have no morals. They fabricate quotations from scriptures. Right? To prove their claim, they come up with this quotation from Garuda Puran. It cannot be found in any of the editions of Garuda Puran we have. If you look up the Garuda Puran today, you cannot find it. So he's basically criticizing the tradition, saying you've made it up. As it so happens, I was able to locate this verse in the writings of Madhvacharya some 1,000 years ago. Madhvacharya quotes the same verse and uses it to make the same point, because he wrote a commentary on the Srimad Bhagavatam. So this idea that the Bhagavatam is the best commentary on the Vedanta Sutra is not something that we invent. It's actually quite an old idea that has been around for at least 1,000 years. But with Jiva Goswami, it's the first time that anyone said, okay, let me prove this claim, let me show it, by actually taking the two scriptures and correlating them. So it really gives a lot of credibility to our claims. This is not something new. Okay, Japanese.
It is that in Madhavacharya's writing, is he or was he quoting from Garuda Puran?
Yeah, he says in the Garuda Puran, he says in his Bhagavat Tatpari Nirna, in his commentary, he names it from the Kyan.
Yeah, so many schools, they doubt about the sources of Madhavas.
Yes.
Quotes because they are not found usually in the existing scriptures.
That's an ongoing debate. The Madhavites, of course, say, though, he was faithful. And since his time, there have been some things he quoted, like Upanishad. There's one, Maitreyeni Upanishad, which he quoted from. No one has ever heard or no one has ever seen after him. Right? So people said he just fabricated, he just wrote it himself. That, they say, has been found since then. It was found in the manuscript library. So therefore, it adds credibility that Madhvacharya was not fabricated. But there's various, actually, scholars doing research on that right now. They're going over these quotations from Madhvacharya that no one else has ever quoted before or after him, before or after him. And going through them and seeing if they can see signs, some consistency, which shows that it was all written by Madhva himself. If all the verses sound very similar, even though they're from different works. So this is what scholars do. They get a kick out of this. Anyway, so he correlates these two, the two things, Vedanta Sutra and the first verse of Srimad Bhagavatam. So let me go through quickly just to show you where he finds all of this. What I'll do first, I guess, is to introduce the Vedanta Sutra. What are the sutras he's dealing with? Does anyone know the first sutra of Vedanta Sutra? Very famous. Difficult as a left-hander to write on the board, because as you write, you keep smudging what's there. So my writing is usually quite horrible on the board. I apologize for that. I thought the Brahmaji, yes. The second one? Does anyone know?
Tanmanis.
Okay,
what?
Sanskrit.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Here's what they mean. Okay, this is as philosophical as Vaishnavism gets. You know, so if you can get this, then basically, yeah, you're a philosopher. it's actually true. I mean, devotees, we often don't realize just the extent of our philosophical capabilities. You know, we consider our philosophy to be pretty simple, and you know, this is such easy ideas: reincarnation, I'm not this body, and karma, and everything like that. But if you take the most basic philosophy of Krishna consciousness that every devotee will know, right, and you go, 90% of the people on the street, just the general populace, will not be able to grasp them. Or the arguments that we make in our classes that are simple, you know, easy arguments, people cannot follow. I've had this experience so many times. We often don't realize just how good our abilities at philosophy get just by listening to Bhagavatam classes and being around in the temple. Devotees should not underestimate their abilities in working with this. Our basic philosophy is usually far beyond what the average person thinks about, you know, on a day-to-day basis. Okay. Athatva Brahma Jigyasa. The meaning of that is... What? Yes. Now, atha, therefore, ataha, inquiry into Brahman. The thing about sutras is that they're very terse, so you'll hardly ever get verbs in them. You have to supply verbs yourself. And most of everything you have to supply. You'll really see that in this one here. Okay? But it's very, very terse, so much so that without a commentary you practically cannot understand. So now, in this human form of life, let us inquire into the absolute truth. Yes. So then the question is, well, okay, inquiry, we should do inquiry into Brahman. What is Brahman? Here's the answer. He from whom everything emanates. Third one, Shastra Yoni Bha.
Scripture is the source.
Yeah, scripture is the source. Shastra Yonipat, Brahman is he who has the scripture as his source. Namely, Brahman is he who is known by scripture. You can know Brahman through scripture. That's the easy way to put it. So, knowledge of Brahman comes through the Shastra, through the scripture. That's one meaning. There's another meaning also. Some acharyas give two meanings. It can also mean the source of scripture. So it's definition of Brahman. Who is Brahman? He is the source of scripture, and it is he who has scripture as his source, namely, who is known by scripture. Okay? So Brahman is known by scripture, and he is the source of scripture. Both meanings are there. Madhvacharya only accepts one. Shankaracharya gives two. Jiva Goswami accepts both. So here's who he is. This is how you can know him. Tattu samanvayat. That is my He's the. You can have. Knowledge of Brahman comes through the process of samanvaya. Brahman is the like I said, the harmonizing principle, the unifying principle behind all scriptural knowledge. So remember, we were talking about yesterday of how, or day before, that. Bhagavan is Viruddha Dharma Ashaya. He's the shelter of all opposing qualities, formlessness and form, smallness and bigness, you know, in one place, like from the Isha Upanishad. They also, all those qualities come together and they just live in Brahman. So everything is harmonized, everything is brought together, some means together, it's all brought together. So you can know him by negative statements and by positive statements. This is Samanvaya. By positive and negative statements. So you can say, Brahman is not this, not this, not this, not this. That's negative statements, right? Neti, neti, neti. So in the Upanishad, you find so many statements like this. Brahman has no hands, he has no feet. God is not here, he's not there. He's not big, he's not small. He's not a human being, he's not an animal. So like that, you can remove things. And then there's positive statements you can get. He is Sat, Chit, and Ananda. He's the origin of everything. He is the shelter of all living entities. Those are positive statements. So you know the Lord in Shastra, right, through both positive and negative statements. This is called Samanvaya. The last one, Ikshate Nashabdam, is refuting a counter-argument. Someone can say, no, I don't believe that Brahman is the source of the universe. In fact, only material nature is. Mother Nature is the source of everything. This is basically the view of modern science. Right? Everything comes from nature, from inert matter. A mixing of chemicals and things are produced. So one could argue in that way. In order to refute that objection, you have the sutra, Ikshate Nashabdam. What? Seeing and hearing.
Seeing and not hearing?
Those are the two key words there. If you read the sutra literally, then it means not non-sound, non-word, because of seeing. This is what the sutra is literally, which is incomprehensible. So that's why you need the commentary. Not word because of seeing. It gives no idea why this sutra is being said. This counter-argument that I just told you, that the world comes from matter, this is also provided by the commentaries. They won't give you, the sutras won't tell you what's in between. What objection why is the sutra being said? Well, I'm objecting to this claim. They won't tell you that. The commentators will tell you, this is the argument which they're rejecting. So basically it's saying that material nature cannot be the source of the world. Material nature is not the only source. Ashabdam. The material nature is because material nature is ashabdam, it is not knowable only through the scriptures. Shabda means coming from the scriptures. Ashabda means not coming only through the scriptures. So material nature cannot be, because it is knowable through other means than just Shabda. And Shabda tells us that Ikshate, that he who is the source of the universe, must be conscious. This is referring to a particular phrase in the Upanishads in which it says, Saikshata bahusyam prajayaya. In the beginning, there was one. Sadeva somyam izamagra asit. In the beginning, the Upanishads give the creation account, how the world came about. But it's very abstract. Everything in the Upanishads is very abstract. There's no names given and things like that. So it says, in the beginning, there was the existent one. That existent one, very mystical. And that existent one thought, let me become many. Let me propagate myself. So he produced, what is it? What's the first thing? Life? Water? Something like that. And in this way the creation came about. So the one existent one decided, I want to become it. He thought, right? So the point here is that the Vedanta Sutra is saying thought. Thought has to be there. And material nature is dead. There is no thought in matter. So it's the exact same argument we use on a day-to-day basis that Prabhupada uses over and over again in speaking to the scientists. Right? How can you say, life comes from life. This is a basic point, right? Life cannot come from matter. That which is conscious cannot come from what is unconscious. The same point is being made here. It's super complicated. You need tons of commentaries to understand what it's saying. But the basic point we use on a day-to-day basis. Right? It's a very simple philosophy. That which is conscious cannot come from. So hopefully this is a little bit of a demonstration as to what I mean when I say that all this is very accessible to devotees. It's presented in a package that is very scholarly, very old, in a particular format of debate that was used 500 years ago. So it becomes very difficult to understand, with a lot of detail, a lot of argumentation back and forth. But thank you to Srila Prabhupada. He's given us all this stuff in very simple terms, and we read over it not realizing that we're dealing with pretty intense Vedantic philosophy. We're engaging in the same debates that have been going on for a long, long time. Something very significant. Okay, so these five things. Now, let's just go to the Srimad Bhagavatam, and this will be the last thing we do. Do people by any chance, did they bring their hand up? I forgot to mention last time that you should. We just need the first verse of Bhagavatam. If you don't have it, it's okay. You should still be able to hold it. Okay, I have one more copy in case anyone's desperately reading. No? Okay. So, Janma Jasya Yaton Baya Ditaratas Chatheshva Bhikya Swara Tene Brahma Hidaya Adikavaye Muhyanti Yatsuraya Tejo Vari Midam Yatha Vinimayo Yatratri Sargo Misha Dhamna Svena Sada Nirastha Bhukam Satyam Param Dhimahi. Okay. Now, is there these five sutras, their meaning, which I just told you, should be found in the first verse of Srimad Bhagavatam. This is Jiva Goswami's task. Is there one correlation you can see very clearly, very obviously? Should be very clear. Janmadhyasya, right? The second sutra is right there exactly. And this is the first evidence that Jiva Goswami gives to say that the Bhagavatam and the Vedanta Sutra are related, that one is a commentary on the other. Is they both basically begin with the same sutra. This is the introductory sutra setting the scene, and this is the first sort of defining sutra, Janmadhyasya. Okay, so that's there already. Now, Athato Brahma Jigyasa. Now we should inquire into Brahman. Most of the commentaries here talk about what is this Brahman, what are his qualities, what is the nature of the absolute truth. That's the discussion that happens here. Where is that found in the first verse? What do you think is a likely candidate in the first verse? If you're familiar with it. Very good. Satyam Param Dhimahi. Satyam Param, the supreme absolute truth. That's the definition of Brahman. Okay. So here we have two definitions of Brahman. Satyam Param and Janmadhyasyata. The absolute truth, the supreme truth, and he from whom everything emanates. Two different definitions. So, Athata Brahma Jigyasa, the meaning of this is pretty much found in Satyam Param Dhimahi.
But the meaning of the first sutra is more about the eligibility for the candidate. Is that the meaning of the sutra, Athato?
Yes. Yes. Athato. Now, that, where could that be found in the first verse? Dhimahi. Now, let us meditate. So, it's talking about that's the Jigyasa part, right? Let us meditate. And now, therefore, dhimahi, we should. That comes because it's a optative form. It's an order. We should meditate on Brahman, dhimahi. Not just people happen to meditate, but we should meditate upon Brahman, dhimahi. Let us meditate. This also refutes Mayavada philosophy, says Jiva Goswami. This word dhimahi. Now let us meditate. Why? Just that word. Why does it refute?
Because it's plural.
Very good. It's plural. So you're talking, the verb is in the plural. There's, now let us meditate. It doesn't say, now let me meditate, as if there's only one person in the world. It says, no, now let us meditate, which presupposes more than one person, which means there must be plurality, not just one. There's more than one. So right off the bat, Jiva Goswami is arguing against Shankara. Okay. Shastra Yonitva. Two meanings of this. Brahman is the source of scripture. He is the cause of scripture. Where is that found in the first verse? Okay. Then, if you know the answer immediately, then don't say it, okay? Because if you already know the answer, this is what I mean to say. This it sort of reduces the exploration for everyone.
Adi Kaveh is
the
source?
Yes, that line, basically. Yes. Tene Brahma Hidaya Adi Kaveh, which means he revealed tene this knowledge to the original poet Brahma in the beginning. So he's the source of scripture. Okay. He can be known through scripture. This is a little more difficult. The second meaning of this. Krishna can be known by scripture. Where is that found in the first verse? Again, if you know it immediately, don't say it. If no one finds out, then you can say what's the likely place? Anyone? Ground two? It's basically this phrase here, anvayad itarathas charteshu, that he is known through the process of studying the meanings of the scriptures, the artha, the meaning of the scriptures. Anvayad itarathas charteshu. And also, the flip side of it is muhyanti yat sudaya. He is, all the great sages are bewildered about him. So, therefore, you need to go to the Vedas. See, there's the point there. Everyone's confused. Muhyanti yat sudaya. All the great sages are confused. Therefore, you need Shastra. He's known by Shastra. Shastra Yonitvanta. Okay? Sorry, I'm going through these very quickly. Jiva Goswami has tons of discussion. There's tons of little things we can get into, you know, how he argues this and where it goes. This is just the bare bones of it. Okay, tattu samanvaya. This should not be so difficult because this word is already found in the verse. Tattu samanvaya. And I've already mentioned it. That word is there. He is known through the process of harmonization of scriptures. And this was the meaning of the sutta. But this word, look for this word, anvayat. It's there. Anvayat itaratash charteshu. That same sutta, that same phrase is used for both of these sutras, partially. Yeah. Krishna is known by the process of positive statements in scriptures, anvaya, and negative statements, itarataha, both. Krishna is known by that. Harmonization. And material nature is not the cause of this this universe, because material nature is dead, is not conscious. Only someone conscious can be the cause. Where is that found? Which word is it? It's crucial.
Sorry?
Nirastha. I should have made a photocopy of that table for you, but I didn't. Okay. Nirastha Kohakam, that's one candidate, because Nirastha Kohakam means that when Krishna is there, material nature or illusion, darkness is completely gone. Very good. That's the one Jiva Goswami selects. Abhigya. The word abhigya means that he is always conscious. He knows everything. He is a conscious entity, abhigya. Let's see, in the. Prabhupada says he is directly and indirectly conscious of all manifestation. So, who is the source of the universe? He's abhigya, always conscious. Therefore, it cannot be material nature. So, that's basically how he's correlating these five. Now, he also finds the other aspects of our philosophy in this first verse also. For example, he goes through all three energies of Krishna, the internal energy, the marginal energy, and the material energy. And he finds them in the first verse also. Where can you find the internal energy in this verse? Where does it talk about the internal energy, Krishna's personal energy? Sorry, I'm presupposing a lot of deep study of this first verse. So the fact that I'm getting answers, I'm quite impressed. Because, you know, the only reason I'm doing this is because I spent 4 years doing it. I'm asking you to come up with it in 5 minutes, which is pretty good. Very good. Tamna Svena. By his own power, by his own potency.
It's actually so, according
to Charanjit, describe
this whole first verse in
relationship to the Lord. That's like a completely rustic way of looking. For example, there's the commentary of Srinath Chakravarti, who was the spiritual master of Kavivayanapura. And he goes to the whole first verse, right, all this complicated terminology in the first verse, and does not mention Vedanta even once. Does not mention, in fact, pretty much any philosophical concept once. You read it and you see Vrindavan there and Goloka and cows and, you know, it's like, oh my God, where's... He's not interested in this stuff at all. This is what I said about the prior interest in rasa rather than jnana. That's definitely there. Okay, so that's the personal energy. Krishna, he's by his own powers, dhamna svena, he does everything. Svena, that's the key word, by his own, personal. Okay. Where's the marginal energy found? This shouldn't be so difficult. Marginal energy means us. Where are we referred to in the verse? Where is it talking about us? It's there in the translation also, the word us.
Oh no, not this translation,
sorry. There's the word I there.
Same demon.
Demon. We make it. It's referring to the marginal energy. Where is the material energy found? The three saga means threefold creation. Excellent. The higher planets, middle planets, lower planets. And also, kuhakam means illusion. Krishna destroys illusion, the illusion power. So there, the three energies are there. So, like this, Jiva Goswami finds practically all of our philosophy, the first five sutras of the Vedanta Sutra, the entire meaning of the Gayatri, like same thing, he correlates each word of the Gayatri mantra with the words of the first verse. He finds the meaning of the Gayatri, the entire meaning of the entire Purana in the first verse, of the entire Srimad Bhagavatam, because it said that the first verse of any book should contain the meaning of the entire book in it. So he finds all the 10 characteristics of Srimad Bhagavatam in the first verse. He finds the meaning of the Gayatri in the first verse. He finds the meaning of the first five sutras in the first verse. And he finds all of the major items of our philosophy, like the three energies, the three forms of Godhead, everything in the first verse. This is the bulk of his commentary on the Paramatma Sandhava. It's all there in the first verse of Srimad Bhagavatam. This is what Prabhupada says, if you understand one line of my books, one verse in my books, then you understand everything. It's all there, it's all packed in. And this is the uniqueness of Srimad Bhagavatam, that in the first verse, you get this intensely philosophical verse, very, very dense, very difficult. It's like basically a string of sutras that's put together. Every phrase in it's very difficult to understand without commentary. Anvayadi taratas charteshu. You know, it's not very clear what's happening there unless you have commentary. Very dense. But by the time you get to the third verse, you're already talking about rasa. Nigamakalpataror galitam phalam shukamukhadam. This is the ripened fruit of the Vedic tree, and it's become even sweeter because it's been touched by the lips of a parrot, Shukadev Goswami. And this just, oh rasikas, oh people of taste, oh bhavukas, oh sentimentalists, oh emotionalists, enjoy, just pibata bhagavatam rasamalayam, just enjoy this nectar of Srimad Bhagavatam. What is the use, what is the need of any other book besides this? So already in the third verse, it's talking about rasa. And it starts off in the first verse talking philosophy. This is the amazing thing about Srimad Bhagavatam, is that it can take intense philosophy and it can take intense emotion and put them together and hold them together like that. It's this perfect balance between these bhakti and jnana. And therefore it works so beautifully for Jiva Goswami's purposes and for our tradition. So I think I'll end there because I don't want to take this as late as... thank you very much for being such an attentive audience and such a participatory audience. This was my first time presenting on Jiva Goswami, so I appreciate your involvement and support very much. And I pray to you that you will give me your blessings, that I can continue to use some of this academic work in Krishna's service. This morning, Bhakti Vigyan Maharaj made a very nice point that bhakti is defined, the definition of bhakti, sarva-badhi-vinirmuktam, free of all upadhis, free of all limiting characteristics. The word in Sanskrit, which is for a degree, an honor, a title, is upadhi. So although bhakti is meant to be free of upadhis, I've spent the last 9 years of my life collecting upadhis. So it's a rather unfortunate circumstance. And it seems that the cards are stacked against my being a good devotee. So I ask you to bless me that I can somehow utilize these upadhis in Krishna service, and in that way make them an asset useful for service rather than something that will be a hindrance to devotional service. And in that way gradually get to the goal of being a better devotee, which is ultimately what we all desire. So thank you very much.